My name is Sven Hughes, and I'm two things. I work as the CEO of a strategic communications company called Enigma Strategic Communications. And then on the side, I'm now also writing novels. So over the last 2 years, I've published two books, both of them set in the world of strategic communications and hopefully providing some useful conversation within that space.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting world, isn't it? And actually, in a way, what you're doing is you're going into the kind of Ian Fleming spy world, something like that, aren't you? Can you just tell us why you decided to start writing novels?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure if I could put my novels in alongside the likes of Ian Fleming, but
what you're doing is you're doing a modern version, really. I mean, that was sort of 1950s and 60s, but today things have changed, and there's still assassinations and things like that going on. There's still criminal gangs out there that want to, get conflict going and want to make a profit out of it, or a geopolitical gains of various sorts. But what is it? What is it about the novel that you think does what you want it to do?
I think it's a way of bringing what I believe to be very important issues to a general public that perhaps isn't through the general media given the way into Stratcoms, to actually say, what is Stratcoms? Who operates in this rather murky world? What are the techniques? What are the clients? What's almost the dark side of Stratcoms that's definitely there, that I've certainly seen over 20 something years working in this industry. And I think it's important to bring that into the public domain. Now, it's not a sort of naming and shaming exercise. More what I'm trying to do is almost sensitize the audience through a good story, through an exciting character development, plot driven story. So that these things are within their sphere of influence to have an opinion, to be able to do something about this, to call for regulation or to be able to see through some of the disinformation that may hit them through their television screens or in their papers or, either knowingly or unknowingly that's disseminated into their news streams.
Yeah, well, this is it, isn't it? Propaganda, disinformation. You don't know it's propaganda or disinformation until you know it is.
That's right. And it's absolutely endemic. And obviously, social media has been, an accelerant. But this is something that's been going on for, since the beginning of time, really. I mean, disinformation and propaganda are in the fabric of warfare. What you're trying to do is sow either unrest or fissures and pinions, we call it in the world, fissures of dividing groups of people, or pinions is making groups of people believe in one thing and building them around that single thing. That's been right there since Alexander the Great and even before that. So it's nothing new. It's now just become more commercialized, more commercially available. There are a lot of companies that now provide these services, and obviously social media is a sort of hotbed of dissemination.
So you chose the topic of the Russian Orthodox Church in this Seal of Confession book, which is about actually the murder of a Russian Orthodox priest. Why did you think that was? I mean, is this the sort of area that strategic communications people really operate in?
No, I that was just a way into the book. I mean, what I wanted to deal with in the book was the grey zone conflict taking place between NATO and the Kremlin. And, I wrote the book 2 years ago. Last year it was published, but it had been bubbling away for a good 6 months before that of the actual writing of it. One of the means by which to get into that story in London was, in this case, through a Russian Orthodox priest. But no, they and as if you read the book, which you have, you'll see that the church is not involved in this kind of stuff. It's the background on a narrative sense for some of the scenes, which I thought would be useful to provide some interesting texture for some of the scenes in the background.
But hang on, because the church is exactly the sort of place, the innocent place, where the intelligence services might hang out, people that want to gain influence might hang out in the church. So although you're not pointing the finger at the Russian Orthodox Church specifically, surely this is exactly the sort of world of influence, you know, that obviously priests. If you actually go back to the Catholic confessional, that does look rather like an intelligence gathering operation. The church is quite an interesting place where these people may hang out, actually.
Well, in so far as, you know, spies hang out in lots of places, including coffee bars and libraries as well, and sporting clubs. I mean, obviously, yes, there is a conspiratorial sense that any church, and of course, propaganda comes as a name from the church in the past, and the Catholic Church in the past. I wouldn't read too much of that into this narrative in terms of the book. I mean,
just you touching on that. So what is propaganda in the Catholic Church? That's an interesting origin, isn't it, for the word?
Mm-hmm. I think it was to do with the Counter-Reformation. I mean, if history serves me correctly in terms of the Counter-Reformation, but I'd need to look up textbooks to give you a full definition without upsetting people in the church, I'm sure, and misrepresenting it. But yes, look, of course, the one thing that you can definitely say about the church, in any church, is the use of parabolic storytelling, the use of narratives to spread influence around the world in a way that doesn't necessarily rely on pictures. So by the very nature of parabolic storytelling, what you have is people wanting to hear stories, in its simple terms, you know, from the Bible or other religious texts, and then passing that information on in a kind of groundswell campaign that gets into the fabric of a society. I mean, to that extent, those techniques still inform some of strategic communications today. So there's definitely a crossover between, you know, you can't paint a picture of the Prophet Muhammad, yet it's in the minds of the audience. It goes through their ears and it's in the minds. And what you could have is a geostrategic superpower of thought, of the imagination, of a collection of people who believe the same thing that crosses and traverses boundaries, traditional geographic boundaries. You know, that is definitely, obviously, a different side of the same coin of an information operations campaign, you know, which is also about trying to get it through the ears and into the heads of the public that you're talking to, so that they feel as though they're spreading the message themselves in a true groundswell sense.
Well, one thing that's come into its own since the Second World War is television. And I was quite amazed that your protagonists, I won't call them heroes, but they're one of them, or a couple of them, I think, are former intelligence agents or officers that have decided to do a kind of freelance operation. One of them's called Clemmy. But they track down the assassin it seems as if this assassin has got an office in one of the big London TV networks. Is there any kind of reason why he decided to use TV as a center for the bad stuff?
Well, it was a news network. It's actually in the book, it's actually, yeah, it's a newspaper, but the point still stands, which is the idea of, if you can infiltrate and influence the messaging of the news, then obviously in terms of the book, you know, that serves the main character arc and also main narrative drive of the book very effectively. Is it true to say that a lot of people, some people, many people, several people who work in psychological operations, military psychological operations or commercial psychological operations in this country and through Europe and through the rest of the world, also, if they're, let's say, reservists, may also have a full-time job in the news or in PR or in an associated skill set, associated job? Yes, well, obviously that's true, because it's a cross-pollination of skills, you know, that you would use within 1 minute in uniform psyops and the next minute in your day job working in a newspaper or television or radio facility. Yeah.
Well, hang on a minute, because certainly when I was working in mainstream TV, the last thing in the world we want is the military there simply spinning their line. The very, you know, most that you'd expect is that a news editor would allow a military person to, you know, have their say. But the idea that the military could actually themselves be involved in the production process, that, I mean, OK, so this is back in the 1990s. I was there. So do you think they may be now?
Well, of course. I mean, if you take any reservist group, let's say if we take Germany or Norway or whatever country you want to take, I mean, they will have a reserve capability of people who work in information operations as a reservist, and then may well have a full-time job. So it's not kind of pure military in the true sense of the word, that there's some sort of covert infiltration of the media by military people. But is there a cross-pollination of skills between reservists and people working on you know, normal civilian jobs, of course, in the same way as there is from the medical reserves in the military in any country and working quite possibly in a hospital or something similar. You know, if people have those skills, then if they're reservists, they're probably going to get streamlined into using those skills for their country.
Yeah, it's very subtle, isn't it, that all of a sudden the actual journalism has got a bit of a military tinge to it. Also, of course, you know, we get a tremendous amount these days about Russia. In fact, probably maybe even since the Russia was removed from the G8 and it became the G7 about 15 years ago, slowly but surely there's been a drip of anti-Russia feeling, the Skripal case, etc. So is there something going on here that we are being sort of told that Russia is not a nice country, they don't do things like we are? Because I've seen this even just last month with Boris Johnson and Partygate. Boris has got to go, the repeated message. We had before that, of course, didn't we? Assad has got to go in Syria. We had before that, we had Gaddafi's got to go. And I wonder whether it's now it's switched on to Putin's got to go, because we've got this really rather bizarre invasion that's taken place, although apparently the Russians don't like talking about it as an invasion, of Ukraine last week.
Well, I think they're two completely different conversations here, which is let's deal with the here and now. You know, the invasion of Ukraine and first in the east and then further in, now encircling Kiev, is a complete calamity, and obviously, you know, any rational person in the West is now saying this should be an existential threat to Putin and his regime. And I don't think there's any doubt, you know, if you're using thermobaric weapons against civilians and you're threatening nuclear weaponry against, you know, other countries and so forth, that there's no conversation to be had. You know, was there previously a complete and utter blunder in our relationship with Russia, self-evidently? Did we take the time to fully understand the motivations of Putin and the Kremlin? Quite clearly not. Did we manage to engage and either de-escalate the situation or put in the necessary interventions to avoid the situation happening in the first place? Absolutely not. And is there now increasingly a strong sense that there has been a hybrid war being fought and we were too complacent to actually recognize it as hybrid war for many years? Yes, that I think that there's pretty compelling evidence to show that's the case. That's part of the reason I wrote the Seal of Confession, which was to say, this is happening. We are not handling it necessarily well. We're not taking the time to understand each other. It's not just understanding Putin, but it's also Putin taking the time to understand the West. And we need to ventilate this conversation. What I was hoping with the book would do was sort of ventilate the conversation in a robust way that, you know, ideally would have preempted and avoided anything like this happening. Unfortunately, maybe I didn't write it quick enough. Maybe I didn't get it published early enough. Maybe
Is it a bit prophetic, Sven, that, you know, you've pointed to this real breakdown of the kind of back channel relations between Russia and the West. I wonder, is there anything that we could have done back in December? Because I can remember there were some quite strong headlines saying, well, look, the Russians are saying we need a new security arrangement, that we've slipped out of the various treaties which were put together by Reagan and Gorbachev. And the, you know, we really do need to kind of sort something out for Eastern Europe. And he was pretty much, the door was pretty much slammed in his face by the Americans.
Well, I think if you look back in history, I mean, not inviting Russia into NATO, I mean, this, the book deals with this in very explicit terms, which is, you know, not inviting Russia into NATO or making them sort of wait in line when Russia wanted to join NATO must, in a historical sense, be seen as a rather a big mistake. And could have perhaps have neutralized this before it happened. Similarly, over the last 10 years, it's way before December last year, you know, over the last 10 years, I think it doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out we have clearly not engaged Russia effectively, and Russia has not engaged the rest of the world effectively. And we should have been both more robust, but also more sort of catmatic as well as dogmatic to work out what were the real motivations, or maybe listen to what Russia was saying were the real motivations for their intent, and to take the necessary steps to avoid it coming to this calamitous situation that it is now. So I was certainly saying it, you know, behind closed doors in lectures I've given to the military. I've had shouting arguments with certain people who are involved in the Russia campaign over the years and not necessarily made best friends by being quite vociferous on that issue, which was part of the reason and motivation to write this book, which is, look, if you're not listening, here's a book that sort of spells it out for you. And the intention was then to use that book to leverage the conversation so that people, whether or not they chose to listen to me or do what I said, is neither here nor there. But the point is, at least it would prompt the conversation. In exactly the same way as my previous book was dealing with golden passports and golden visas and saying this single industry is doing more to upset the democratic process than pretty much anything else I can see. And yet every single time I try and talk about it in the public domain or in lectures or in the media and so forth, it achieves absolutely nothing because we have our government and many other governments around the world have been facilitating this to for their own tactical short term, making some money ambitions. And the consequence is what they've done is essentially sell passports and enable people on the FBI most wanted list, spies, murderers, and that kind of stuff has been going on. Now it's going to gradually be revealed over the coming weeks, I think, of just what exactly has been going on in the name of golden and passports. But again, you know, there's only so much I can say in a public capacity where, you know, at some point you just sit down and write a book and say, look, would this, if I tell you a good story about it, would that at least get you to think about it? You know, and that seems to be now one of the more effective ways, you know, that I can get people to at least discuss these issues.
Sounds like you're the sort of person, Sven, that would have been very frustrated just in the strategic communications industry that you were in for a while. And is this why you cut out and set up your own business?
Well, obviously, I worked at various companies in Stratcoms before setting up my own companies. Yeah, I mean, I didn't necessarily agree ethically with some of the companies that I worked for, and one particularly that I worked for. So I left it and set up in competition to them with an ethical sort of mandate for the company, a premise of the company being its ethical influence. And that's something we still practice today. We select our clients incredibly carefully. We turn down a lot of work. We don't use big data. We won't go near it. We only do attributable campaigns that are, you know, and I've sat with prime ministers and refused to represent them unless I was convinced and sure that they are clean, that their financing is clean to run a campaign, and that they are, you know, reaching the sort of standards that I want to promote in this industry. So I think, you know, yes, frustrated before, but very resolute in my wish to do something about it in my professional lifetime, you know, and trying to do something about it. I'm a firm believer we need regulation in this industry. I took my recommendations to the select committee when the Cambridge Analytica story was sort of, or the interviews were happening in front of the select committee. I've taken it to the FBI, my belief in that, and put my case over to these people. Unfortunately, sadly, to this point, the members of parliament, both in the select committee and other ones that I've spoken to, haven't done nearly enough, nearly quickly enough to satisfy me that they were taking it seriously. One of the consequences, I think, perhaps of what's happening in Ukraine at the moment is this is being totally sort of revealed, or has the potential to be completely revealed and opened up. We need to see that Russian, the Russia document. We need to see what was on the servers of the Cambridge Analytica servers. That's never been brought to bear in the public domain. And then we need to see what is the kind of money that's being passed through some of these people who got golden passports into the pockets of our politicians. And I very much hope that the disinfectant of sunlight will be, will happen in this case. Let's see. I mean, I'm yet to believe that any politician really wants to clean up this business, because it's what gets them into power. And if they try and clean it up, the very people who put them into power will take them out of power rather than have the industry cleared up. So it's quite a high stakes game. And that's why, again, that's why I write books about it, is to try and get people in the general public, at least, more aware of what is sort of, at least I do it through fiction, but more aware of what's actually going on, so that they feel furnished to ask their members of parliament what they are or have been failing to do, and to come up with some decent answers.
Well, when you see something so discrediting as Partygate get rolled out, do you sometimes scratch your head and wonder whether there are some strategic communications people behind that? Because it did seem as if it was over several weeks, a very concerted campaign on all platforms, really, and strategically spaced releases of photographs, documents, information. Is that the sort of thing that a really good strategic communications person, maybe not an ethical one, can unseat a prime minister, for example?
Oh, 100%. And not just do I believe that. I mean, I've gone on the record and said it. If you go onto my LinkedIn at the moment, you'll see I actually have up there a post which I wrote as it was happening, saying, I can see the fingerprints of a strategic communications company here, and this is what will happen next over the next few days and weeks. And I went on the radio and actually predicted what would happen the next week, including Sue Gray handing in her report, what would be said by the Prime Minister, where the Prime Minister would fly to. He would have pictures of himself with tanks. Then Liz Truss. I mean, you can literally see that in the public domain, me predicting the step-by-step of at least, I think, 7 or 8 days. And it's exactly what happened. It literally is exactly what happened. I mean, MPs, I was literally giving quotation marks saying, this is what MPs will say. And they were going onto the television and radio stations and saying this, and it was predicted before. So it's not rocket science. I mean, a lot of people out there are trained to do these techniques. It's not I'm some sort of Jedi mind tricks expert. There are a lot of people who could have predicted that. Sadly, the cynicism, I think, that's happening amongst the voters is they feel rightly that pretty much everything they're hearing has gone through the lens of a Dominic Cummings or an equivalent. And I have a very, very big problem with the ethics and morals of many of the people working in this unregulated industry. We need regulation. We need laws. We need accountability. We need transparency. We need to know the names of some of these people, and need to be able to hold them to account. And if it is demonstrated they've been using untoward behavioral techniques on the population, which I think is against the Geneva Convention, or if it is the case that some of the reservists who are actively serving in information operations were overextending their reach when they were working in the cabinet office during COVID, I think people have to know this, and there have to be people held to account. We cannot continue with such a powerful weapon system. This is a weapons grade information operations capability that must not be used in the civilian space in an unregulated and sort of opaque manner.
Okay, look, but you've said it yourself, Sven, that the people that get into power rely on this system to get into power. They're not going to, it's like, you're not going to get them. It's like turkeys and Christmas, isn't it? You're not going to get them to do it because they rely on this system. What would you like to see, though, if there was some proper regulation of strategic communications?
I'd like to see an answer in terms of why the select committee, when I gave them the evidence at the time of what was going on, chose not to act on it, chose not to ask the questions of Alexander Nix that I provided for them, which would have revealed the truth. I'd like to know why so many of those people essentially, as far as I can see, help cover it up rather than reveal it. Now, that's a strong thing to say, and I'm sure they would defend themselves saying, no, they did the best they could. But if you look at the Russia report that was published, and you look at the sanctions that should have been applied and the questions that should have been asked, is another example of pretty much nothing was done up until a couple of weeks ago. It was all being swept under the carpet, as it will be, of course, with Partygate, which is accountability and genuine accountability seems to be at the moment just being kicked into touch, which is, well, we've got much more important things to think about now, which is war. So that seems like frippery, the idea of people having bottles of wine and parties and so forth. And this nonsense excuse of, oh, well, I don't know if I was at a party because the police have to tell me if I was. You know, it's doing so much damage to the trust between the civilian population and politicians, and then the civilian population potentially with this industry of stratcoms, and then as an extension of that, the civilian population and the military personnel or reservists who also work in this industry with information operations capabilities and were certainly involved with COVID. You know, so I think it just in every single way, this is this has to be sorted out once and for all. I can only do so much myself. I hope people listening to this will take more of an interest, either read my books or go and research this online on Google and so forth, because I do feel as though slightly, how long have I known you, Tony? We've known each other for a good number of years now. Every single time I've spoken to you in person or on recorded has been on this topic. I've been bleating on about this with you for at least 10, 12 years. You were one of the first people I did an interview on BBFC, FM or whatever it was called at the time. You know, you have been pushing this narrative, and I really thank you for that. Very few other journalists have. They may have their vested interest, they may not, but it's time now to expose the people who, for vested interests, haven't been exploring this, be that politicians, journalists, members of parliament, whatever, and find a way to replace them so we can start cleaning this up once and for all.
Well, it certainly is a dirty world, the broadcasting world, far more dirty than when I was working in mainstream broadcasting. If we do nothing, where is this heading? Because that's what bothers me. It looks to me as if whoever pays the piper is going to basically decide on our futures. And that is an extremely worrying world to be in, where people can be conned and convinced to do things that they would never normally want to do because the information they're basing their voting decisions on is simply not being interrogated by anybody.
Well, I think you've answered your own question there, which is, if it continues the way it is, the notion of democracy is for the history books. And I've seen that myself when I was working at SCL, the precursor to Cambridge Analytica. I was head of elections. That's the company I left on ethical grounds. What I saw was, as far as I am concerned, personally at the time, looking at it and being a part of it, nothing short of a complete and utter compromise of the democratic process, you know, and using techniques and using both techniques and technology that was nothing short of corrupting of the entire political process for commercial gain, for someone paying so they got a return on messing up the various democracies that we're involved with. That's where it's going. I've seen it firsthand. I've seen it in various countries when I was working for that company. I've seen what it can do to governments, to prime ministers, leaders, opposition, and the, you know, it completely undermines everything that we supposedly believe in or fought wars for or teach our children to believe in and espouse to the next generation. So if we don't sort this out, well, that's it. We're going to hell in a handcart and of our own making.
Well, there's a lot of people in Ukraine who wonder quite where they're heading this week. And I noticed that we've seen the first switchings off of the RT channel. I note that during the Second World War, we didn't stop the broadcast of Lord Haw Haw, the Nazi broadcast of William Joyce, who after the war was hanged as a traitor. But he was broadcasting from Radio Luxembourg right the way through World War II without being jammed. The British decided, well, we're just going to let him talk. And we will, lampoon him, we'll ridicule him. We'll also counter his information with our own information because we are not afraid of other voices. It seems nowadays we are afraid of another voice, and that voice is RT, which is getting switched off in some places as we speak.
Yeah, I actually tend to agree with you on this one. I think that if you believe that RT is a propaganda machine for the Kremlin, fine. But by leaving it on, you can do exactly as you say. You can draw attention to the inaccuracies, to the lies, to the fabrications, whatever it may be. And then you can counteract it with robust arguments and win the hearts and minds of the population that way with truth and credibility. What I worry about is that then the response will be to switch off the BBC. You know, and we know that millions are tuning in both in Russia and Ukraine at the moment to the BBC to get what they perceive to be a balanced view of events. Now, you could argue that both ways. It's very difficult to complain about Putin switching off or restricting Facebook if we then switch off media here as well. You know, so yes, I on that particular issue, I also think it's a sort of tactical mistake, because what it almost gives that notion that we are afraid of what they're saying rather than we're not afraid of what they're saying and let's discuss it sensibly. But yes, I agree with you on that one.
Don't you think it's likely to almost make RT more cool to drive it underground?
It could do. I mean, it could just put it out of business as well. I mean, so only the fullness of time will be there. I mean, I think the sentiment now is so strong and so consistent in so many areas of our society, both cultural, defence, political, economic and so forth. I don't necessarily see that RT is going to survive this one. You know, I think there just isn't the audience there for it now. However, there will be, I'm sure, an equivalent to RT and that, you know, in the same way as we have essentially propagandistic broadcasting mechanisms into countries, us, America, Europe and so forth, and always have done. So in this case, it's probably a busted flush for that particular broadcaster, but there'll be others in the future and possibly not maybe just online versions, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they're almost certain to continue on doing that sort of thing, mm-hmm. particularly since, you know, very few young people actually switch on TVs and watch these things on Sky or Freeview or whatever. Most of them will get their news feeds, they get little clips on Telegram, they'll get it on social media, and of course RT will be on there, I would imagine, in the future. Anyway, Sven, what do you make of the whole psychology behind Ukraine? Because I wonder whether, you know, just stepping back from it a minute, whether it's a little bit like on the east side of Russia back in the 1980s, Afghanistan, where this could potentially be a trap that Putin has fallen into here, that the negative feeling, the deaths generated by their invasion of Ukraine could actually be exactly what the West wants. And the West may be rubbing their hands quietly behind the scenes saying, great, they've fallen into a trap here.
Yeah, I mean, of course he has. And it's now an existential threat on Putin and his regime. And it looks as though it's a one way ticket to that, because he's lost he didn't pre-sell this to his own public in Moscow. I mean, I was in Moscow a week or so ago, you know, and there was general goodwill towards him before he started this. The moment he started this, which is killing brother Slavs for no other reason than a sort of seemingly quite a tsarist projection of himself and Russian, Great Russia in on the map, he's absolutely lost his own side in this. I mean, of course he has. And he's completely misjudged the Ukrainian sentiment. He's misjudged the readiness of his own army. We can see that with the logistics and the running out of food, weapons, petrol and everything else. You know, they thought it was going to be a, you know, cavalier sort of trip down the road. 3 days later, they would have taken over Kiev and put in a puppet administration. He's totally and utterly miscalculated everything. Now, whether or not that therefore means it was a trap by the West, I'm not so sure, because I don't think that the Western planning in this instance was so entirely farsighted. I know that history will be rewritten to some extent and saying it was, but I'm a little bit more cynical of that. I think just operationally he has screwed it up so much it's just played into the West's hands. He's facing it. Look, one of them's going to die. It's as simple as that. It's going to end with a Russian tragedy. One of them's got to die. It's either going to be one of the snakes has to have its head cut off. It's either Zelensky or it's Putin. And it's now that, whereas before it was only about Zelensky and it was only a matter of time and how is it going to do it. Now there is a very real possibility this will be the thing that takes down Putin. And by his own doing, by his own failures, you know, which would I don't think anyone could have projected that quite.
No, maybe not. But the day before, I noticed Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, said, "Oh, I think we should be re-equipping ourselves with nuclear weapons." And when he said that, I remember thinking, gosh, this is almost like a deliberate provocation designed to press all Putin's buttons.
And I'm sure there is an element of this being a sort of passive-aggressive, self-fulfilling prophecy by the West because of our lack of proper engagement. We should never have got to this stage with Russia. Russia should never have got to this stage with us. You know, Russia lost 24 million people defending the very freedoms that we now obviously enjoy and preach about. You know, it's the largest loss of life in the Second World War, I think, on any of the Allied side, I think I'm right in saying. You know, if it wasn't for the Russians standing up in to beat fascism, God knows where we'd be. So if only somehow during the 90s, we could have adopted that in our hearts and our heads rather than basically, you know, raping the country. And I know that Putin has subsequently done it as well. I'm not stupid. I mean, I'm fully aware that his kleptocratic regime afterwards has done even worse. But there wouldn't have been that ability to do that had we handled it differently. Now, that's the benefit of hindsight, of course. But an awful lot of people were saying it at the same time. An awful lot of people were saying at the time, do not extend NATO to the east. It is literally the worst thing you can do. And it will be a running sore that will come back to bite us. I mean, there were very esteemed politicians saying it at the time. Their voices obviously were drowned out, were not the ones that were listened to, and we are where we are. Yes, there is a great deal of soul searching that needs to be done from the Western side. Obviously, of course, that does not in any way change the fact that what Putin is doing right now at this moment is nothing short of a disgrace. It is immoral. It is wrong. It is barbaric. And he should stop.
Well, the response is also very overwhelming. It's extreme. All sorts of communication channels being switched off. Russia completely shut out from international sport, from finance. I wonder whether this is now on a ratchet, Sven, and it's heading in a rather worrying direction for our kids' sake. You know, that this is something which is almost unstoppable, that at some point we are going to come to blows. It's like we have decided we're never going to speak to Russia again.
Well, I mean, if it carries on, I mean, the only thing that Russia has to do is stop. It's very simple. It's stop and turn around, you know, and what the world is definitely saying to Russia is if you don't do that, you will end up like North Korea. You know, I mean, it's very simple. There will literally be nothing left. It is desperately sad. You know, I'm a complete Russophile. I adore Russia. I'm married to a Russian. I have children who speak both languages. You know, so I am absolutely heartbroken to see what's happening because of some extremely shoddy decision making in the Kremlin. You know, and it's an absolute tragedy what's happening to Russia. And I completely agree. The sooner it stops, the better. And if Russia can be rebuilt and restructured and be a completely different relationship with the West going forward, and we can have sensible conversations between what is left of Russia and NATO in a good-hearted way as one human race trying to build something successful collectively rather than avariciously and so forth between each other, I can only hope that happens in our lifetime, Tony. But at the moment, it's not looking good.
Can you just let us know how we can follow you on social media, etc., and find your Enigma company?
Yeah, I'm just literally completely transparent on social media. Just search my name, Sven Hughes. The books are all on Amazon. My company is open. We show all our clients. I'm often in the press and on radio talking about these subject matters. I'm on Twitter all the time talking about it, on LinkedIn. I don't close my posts. Anyone can talk to me, and I'll happily talk back to them on any of these issues within the realms of what I know or don't know, obviously, you know.
Okay, Sven Hughes, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.